Hello, welcome back to the podcast that is still, for some reason, called The Caution Period, but we should probably think of a new name, given that apparently COVID's over now, according to many, many people, including the British government. I'm joined by Pete and Martin. Say hello.
Hello.
And it's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been a long, long while. A lot's happened.
I thought I might look up how long it was, but then I decided actually that would be horrifying because it's probably over a year, isn't it?
That almost sounds too much like research as well. It's like, absolutely screw doing that. That's too much like work.
I think we can all agree that time basically has fucking ceased to have.
I think you'll find it's been over a year, Mike.
Yeah, it's been well over a year.
Right? I think it's been 2 years.
Shit. I'm not gonna bother editing out the swearing. I got bored of doing that as well. So
no, I was gonna say fuck
this is explicit podcasting.
we're back and we're X-rated.
Yeah.
Anyway, motorsport still exists as a concept and a sport. And we've been watching it, haven't we?
There's been a lot of motorsport. There's been so much motorsport. Mm. There's almost too much motorsport at one point.
Last weekend, you mean?
No, I'm actually thinking more towards the end of last year. Although we shouldn't talk about it because
no point in motorsport continuing because peak motorsport happened because a car ended up in the flowers at the fountain at Long Beach.
That was incredible.
The best thing. That was like, because I'd never seen that before, and when it happened, I was like, this is the best thing I've ever
seen.
Not
only did it end up in the flowers, it ended up in the flowers backwards. It didn't crash into the flowers.
It crashed and then
parked on the flowers.
Yeah, it looked like he was like, oh, I missed the flowers. And then he had another crack at it.
It was Castro Neves, wasn't it, right? Who did it? Right.
Pagano. It was Pagano.
Pagano, okay.
But yeah, it was like, and the amount of effort that must have gone into that flower bed, because that flower bed
it looks
on
beautiful.
Like the roundabout in the first corner of Long Beach.
It's exquisite.
It's one of the best flower displays in motorsport, I think. Mm. I'm happy to
there's that,
to
and there's
state
the,
that.
It's, I like that little like lumpy mound with sort of plant life on it. And the other lumpy mound with plant life that I like is, do you remember the Poe street circuit? Do you remember that? From like
I've only ever played it in games. Yeah, so I have no idea if it actually exists in real
life.
But
there's a sort of, there's a, like a roundabout or something where there's just a big lump of grass. And do you remember Augusto Farfus in like years ago in the WTCC rolled his car and then won the following race? They like hammered all the dents out of it, and then he won the following race.
Oh, I think I remember that.
But yeah, it's like,
did you mention it?
It's probably like a lot.
I've got some rhododendrons at the same time though.
I think so, or just a bit of like lawn mowing at least. But yeah, it's a proper just big lump to launch your car over, and he fully launched it over there.
I do like Pagano's commitment though, because it like, and I hope that he gets as much bounce about that as possible, because he had no need. There was no need at all to completely destroy the flower bed, but he just, because he missed it, and he was like tried to do a J turn or something. But it just looked like he just drove up onto the flowers and parked and was like, I'm going to leave it here, lads.
See you later. Then basically spun the rear wheels on someone's prize flower display. It was pure hooliganism. But I condone it. Yeah, it was lovely.
Was the Long Beach race the better race of the weekend? Let's just get this out of the... was it better than Melbourne, or was it worse?
Not if you're Colton Herter, it's not.
I loved the Long Beach race, but I was, because it was quite late, I was like half cut and a bit stoned, so I was like, this is just having the best time. But in defence of the Adelaide race, obviously...
Adelaide?
Great.
We made Adelaide,
Melbourne. This shows how old I am.
You said time Melbourne, has no meaning. Martin's gone back to 1984.
Yeah. Wow.
In defence of the Melbourne race, there was a really good piece, I think, by Matt Kew in Autosport today, or yesterday even, about how it was actually really good to have a race that was neither exciting or boring, with no drama, because F1 has been way too dramatic for too long. There's been, like, since, I think, Brazil last year, every race has been absolutely,
chaos.
Mired in controversy. And there's...
You mean it's nice to have a napping race back?
Mm. No, because it wasn't quite a napping race. I thought it was a good race, and also it was a what Will Buxton would call a Grand Chelem, I think, or a Grand Slam. I always love seeing those. That was Charles Leclerc's first. Do you know who's got the record for most? Do you know who's got the record for most Grand Slams?
Pastor Maldonado.
Yes.
Wow.
No, it's Jim Clark with 8.
Really?
That's not a lot of Grand Slams, is it?
And I think Lewis Hamilton's behind him, off the top of my head, of 6. And then it's like Schumacher and Vettel and that, and a few people tied on 5.
What's the criteria? Is it every free practice session and
I don't
quality?
Think so.
And
I
fastest lap and
fastest lap it's and race.
I think it's literally just I don't think it's the free practice session.
Is it just pole, fastest lap and win?
Pole position, fastest lap, and but lights to flag. Which is
lights to flag.
So were they still tracking this when fastest lap wasn't a points giving thingy?
Yeah, they would have done because it's still like an accolade, isn't it?
So, but before we, I do want to before we leave sight of the roundabout incident.
Let's not.
What is the best trackside ornament in professional motorsport?
Well, it was Snetterton's scary tree, but
there's the oak tree at Virginia
Where
International
was that?
Raceway.
I don't. Oh yeah, of course. Where's the scary tree? It's Snetterton. I don't remember it.
The scary tree is as you approach the. So you come through turn one, which is a fast right hander, and then you head down towards the hairpin, the right hand hairpin, and there used to be a tree that looked like this. Freaking like monster screaming at the sky, but a few years ago it ended up getting like blown down in a storm or something. Or
same with the oak tree at Oak Corner at VAR too.
The KFC and Mulsanne are they that really
the KFC?
Kind of,
yeah, that's a good shout. How have we never been there though? Like we've been to Le Mans like multiple times, but we've never actually been to the KFC and got a KFC.
That's life goals, and some people go for that really nice like.
The one that has
challenge is a family bucket.
We've got to go to that KFC and get the double down burger, the one that's chicken between two pieces of chicken.
Because it's the bit of like Le Mans that doesn't feel like terribly accessible during the race, right?
Yeah, Mulsanne's always an.
But
is
that KFC open during the race? It can't be because there's literally no way to get to it if the road is closed.
Unless you're that. Like was it Rockefeller when he launched himself out of the Audi and got lost?
And he landed in the drive-thru.
He ended up at KFC.
Boys, we are doing Le Mans next year, right? You
100%
this.
For Ferraris.
Wait, is that this year or next year?
Not this year. This year will
this
be rubbish.
This year is kind of one of those.
Next year will be rubbish.
Next year's Ferrari and Porsche and who else is going to be there as well?
NASCAR. NASCAR's going to be there.
Wait, we're going to it or actually we're doing it? Because we've got to raise some money.
Oh, racing it. Yeah, we're driving. Okay. You're driving
the
NASCAR, Pete.
Yeah, you've got the NASCAR license, right? You should just talk
to
the
contact. Do you think that'll transfer, okay?
Yeah,
the
I
one
think
that
will, yeah.
You just have to pay money for. But I was going to say, a hat tip to the castle at Baku, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, the castle walls. Yeah, good. Yeah, Baku normally like chucks up a half-decent race, doesn't it?
You could pick... All of Monaco, right?
That works.
It's a pretty good trackside ornament. How about Paul Ricard's hypnosis lines? No, not those.
I do feel like they're in danger of hypnotising someone off the circuit, which is a bit of a problem.
It'll make the races more exciting.
Orton Park's got that nice stadium. I've never been to Orton Park myself. Obviously, it's British GT there, as you said earlier, Mike. But that's got that nice stadium.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that it looks great in photos because you've got the cars coming towards you and you can see it in the background. It's that lovely like red stone wall. But actually, when you're driving the circuit, you don't see it at all because it's totally behind you. You're looking down the circuit. So I think a trackside ornament has to be like visible while you're driving the track. Those should definitely be the rules, right?
Can you see the big bronze bull at Red Bull?
Oh,
I was going to say that's all I could think of is the big bronze bull, and I don't want to think about it.
The one that's better is what's the track in America that has a giant freaking spider on it for no reason?
Yeah, I was thinking about that one. Yeah,
is that like?
But is it Barber?
Is that Barber? Yeah, it feels like it's Barber Motorsport. Yeah. They're going IndyCar again then, like next giant spider. Yeah, it's the giant
I know
spider.
Someone. I used to work with someone.
It's actually real. It's a real spider.
I used to work with someone who didn't drive, and his reason for not driving was because he's scared of spiders, and he was worried that if you don't, I'm not going to name him. Just you can name him, like,
Jeffrey.
Let's just say Jeffrey.
This is a brilliant story.
Yeah, he just didn't. He just chose not to drive because he was worried that if he ever did learn to drive, what if a spider was in the car at the same time and like came out of like and just dropped on his lap or something? He wouldn't know what to do and he would just have to crash immediately.
Yeah, he was like, I'm so arachnophobic that if a spider landed on me,
I didn't think you were going to say arachnophobic.
I would crash and kill other people. Like it would be a big enough accident.
Does that ever happen to Barber? Has an arachnophobe ever raced at Barber and just gone, ah, and just screamed?
Swerved
and just
off.
No, when that happens, they put a blanket over it. so you can't see it.
It's like when you enter Indy and you have to choose which milk you want. They have like a little checklist at the start of the race weekend. And if anyone's ticks, they have to cover this
big crane that drops like an upturned massive glass on it.
Yeah. And it freaks out.
Yeah. And they slide the card underneath.
All right. Well, I think we solved that question. Any other like hot takes from the IndyCar before we move on to Formula One?
Well, quite enjoying reading that article in the race earlier about why IndyCar drivers haven't made it to Formula One. It was making it seem like IndyCar races are so all over the place. Like the chance of like you could be the best driver, the best car in IndyCar, but still there's a lot of people on fairly equal footing, and the races are quite unpredictable. Cautions can mess things up. So like, you know, even like the Dixons of the world who've dominated. If you look at their record, they're kind of it was looking at like. I think they pulled out a stat like Palou's, the guy who won the championship last year, his average finishing position was like fifth.
Yeah.
And Verstappen's was 1.4. And like Formula One teams look at consistency. So if they look at IndyCar drivers, they're like, wow, these guys are just, they're all over the shop. So they're unhireable when it comes to like an F1 seat. And they're like, well, you know, IndyCar does itself a disservice because it is so unpredictable a series that,
I didn't have time to read the article because I spent 4.5 hours in the car driving what should have been a 3-hour journey. But did it try and dig into why it's more inconsistent in IndyCar?
Well, yeah, because it's like, you know, obviously there isn't an order of, you know, it's not like in Formula One where like, you know, the sheds start at the back and they're probably going to finish at the back. Yeah, the field spread is a lot less in IndyCar.
In IndyCar, they're all sheds. Every car's a shed. So
yeah, exactly. But
F2's a spec formula.
That's the thing. I read the article. I was like, this doesn't make sense. And like the third paragraph in, I was like, I'm already disregarding anything in this article. Because the guy was like, oh, yeah, IndyCars are really difficult to drive. You can't, unless you can control the oversteer that they have, then you know, you're not going to be able to be competitive. And I'm like, they don't appear that oversteery. I mean, they do when you're on a street circuit and they're bumping around and like someone yeets the throttle and it gets like
what happened at Long Beach.
Yeah, but the thing is, when was the last time you saw an IndyCar go backwards into a tyre wall? Like, they're always going frontwards into the tyre wall.
Yeah,
like the front end always gives up.
But I was surprised at how many times that happened. Like, I saw Graham Rahal did it a few times as well. And they just, at some pace, would just drive straight into a wall and then just reverse out and just carry on as if nothing happened. Things are just...
That's the definition of understeer, is it not? Like,
it is.
Like, I get it. They're not easy cars to drive, right? And they're quite brutal to keep hold of and things like that. But again, to your point, Mike, no different to F2. Ultimately, I think why the drivers don't make it from IndyCar to Formula One is, and this article does not touch on this, is the fact that you get people like Ericsson and Grosjean, who are known quantities in Formula One, going in and looking really good. And then you get people like Rossi, who, you know, it does look quite good in IndyCar, and really, I mean, I know he was driving like the Manor at the time or whatever it was, or Marussia, and didn't really get a chance. But the thing is, to get that far in Formula One, to even be considered into a seat in Formula One, there's so much data about you for the junior series. Everyone knows what you're capable of doing. So if you go into IndyCar and as a benchmark of that performance in Formula One. And I know that, like, yeah, they didn't get a chance to really prove themselves. They were never in a car that's good enough. But my point is more about the feeder series to get there and the junior categories and the junior teams people drive in. There's so much data about these drivers that they're just, as soon as they appear in IndyCar and they look really strong, it devalues the rest of that field, unfortunately. And then Colton Herta, one of the best upcoming drivers of IndyCar, apparently, keeps binning it when he's leading races, which is not a good credential to have.
Well, that's the thing, because like Andretti's bid seemed to be built around Colton Herta, basically. The whole Andretti F1 bid is like, let's get Colton Herta on the grid. It's like,
I don't know. I mean, like, if he's adaptable, and I feel like, you know, there's some people just like suit certain cars better than others. Do you know what I mean? Like, some people adapt their driving style. Because the thing that I always come back to when it comes to comparisons between like top level US motorsport and F1 is Bourdais. Bourdais did dominate in Champ Car. He absolutely destroyed the field. Yeah. Like, he was unstoppable in Champ Car. And he came to F1 and he was like barely average.
We haven't. It's been obviously the same thing happened with Zanardi as well, didn't it? But like, when was the last time? Was Jack Villeneuve like the last good IndyCar driver in F1? Or Montoya
maybe.
Yeah, Montoya. And Montoya was something really special. Like, yeah,
and also he did. He spent a lot of time in the European feeder series and almost made it into Formula 1, then went to IndyCar and then came back to Formula 1. So he was fairly well known as on the European side too. But I mean, it's such a boring topic to bring up tyres, but that was the other thing the article did bring up, which is a good point, is that the Pirelli tyres that Formula 1 use are fairly, they kind of get used to them in the lower series, don't they? Like F2 tyres aren't the same, obviously, but they're a similar kind of... That tyre prep skill is needed for that series as well as it is in Formula 1. And like, if you, it gets very different in IndyCar. It's not easier, right? They don't have tyre blankets, but the Firestones aren't, I don't think, as peaky. Yeah. And it's...
Well, they're built like a race tyre rather than a tyre built for the show, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So
I mean, it's I get where IndyCar's coming from. Ultimately, I don't want IndyCar to change because it does make good racing. But I do think people need to realise that IndyCar is, I think that's such a horrible opinion to have, but I don't look at the drivers in that and think these are the best drivers in the world.
No, partly because
we've got like, Grosjean is doing really well, and Grosjean's not a bad driver, but he's not.
He's not top tier F1.
If he was, he would have been. I think I hate that whole thing about like, if you're a good driver in Formula 1 and you get put in a shitty team, you never get given a chance. I think Russell's proven the fact that like, you drag that car into Q3 enough in the Williams, people are going to take notice of it, aren't they?
And you absolutely show your teammate.
Formula 1 paddock does realise. Yeah, so like Grosjean's, who I respect an awful lot, I think he's a fantastic driver, and I've always enjoyed watching him race and everything. Like he has gone and made IndyCar drivers look a little like we expected them to be, right? Because he's gone in and adapted really well, and racecraft is actually could have been a bit shoddy on the F1 side. He looks like an absolute weapon on the IndyCar side, doesn't he?
Yeah,
because he's not crashing when he's leading.
Yeah,
and then further down from IndyCar is NASCAR, based on Jimmy Johnson's performance.
He did have his
wanking injury, in fairness, which hinted him a little bit.
But they made him a little carbon fibre splint for it, so he could continue.
Hurt himself in practice? Did he hurt himself in practice or not? I can't remember what.
Yeah, it was practice. He hurt himself in practice. Then
they hurt himself again in practice.
They splinted it up for quali. He crashed in quali, I believe.
When you say practice, you mean because wanking is basically practice. That's what you mean when you say practice.
Yeah, it's practice for when you meet a lady. And then he crashed.
What's
in the
qualifying then, Mike? What's the fast six?
It's the number of seconds I tend to last. But he crashed in the race. But he crashed late in the race. That's good. You know, Long Beach is difficult. Long Beach is tricky, right? It's quite a fast.
I do think IndyCar is a difficult series. I'm not taking anything away from the drivers that are in it. I mean, other than I am, but the
the last 10 minutes where you've been taking it away.
The issue is that I hold Formula 1 and Formula 2 at a very high standard. Yeah. I do think
you say that though. You hold Formula 1 to a high standard. I don't think you'd ever get the nonsense we saw from Lance Stroll this weekend in IndyCar. I don't think that should. I think what we saw from Lance Stroll and Melbourne should not be in any sport what he didn't qualify in. It's just
I don't know what's going
awareness.
On with those Canadian rich boys. But like,
it's nuts, isn't it?
I think you've answered your own question. It's that they've got a lot of money.
Yeah,
and that's why
wasn't it Brundle in like not this race but the last race? Like one of the commentators was saying that like Stroll does have a problem looking in his mirrors when he turns into corners. He just assumes everyone's gone. Like it's like meh. And then seems to be surprised when he has accidents. But I still think Stroll's fairly quick though.
Yeah, no, he is.
He has his moments.
In a lower form. Look at his record in lower formulas as well. He's a good peddler, but he just doesn't have the that final kind of 1%.
I think his racecraft's just terrible, isn't it?
Yeah,
that as well. Yeah, basically.
He needs to spend more time like sim racing because like that's a quick way to learn some racecraft. right?
Isn't there isn't the sort of rumor that he doesn't actually like motor racing? He probably last thing he wants to do is his dad made him do it, and so
no, I don't think that's true. He just doesn't like being bad at motor racing, and because of you know who he is, it ends up happening quite a lot that he gets upset.
But. Is he like the prince in the castle in Monty Python? He's like, Dad, yeah. I just want to sing.
I just want to sing.
He's like, no, you're getting in the car. We're going to Monaco. And he's like, no.
Latifi, on the other hand, not very good, really, to be honest.
But quite handsome, though, so it's all right.
He's no Charles Leclerc.
I think he's all right, isn't he?
He's got
the
nice
right
smile.
Components. They just don't seem to be in the right order on his
You've seen his dick?
I meant like facial components, but his penis is upside down.
I imagine it looks a lot like the Williams front nose, which is not the most pretty sight in the world.
We're not allowed to use that term, by the way. The front nose term is banned from all.
What? Because there's no such thing as a rear nose.
I don't know why everyone says front nose all the time. Martin, can you apologise for our listeners?
I would apologise. So, what should I say? Front wing assembly. The front. What should I say? The nose.
Just nose. You can just say nose.
You're right, but it shouldn't be front nose. But there should be a rear nose, though.
Unless we create a rear nose. What is the
rear
nose?
Let's create a rear nose.
Is that the crash structure that sticks out the back? Is that the rear nose?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Okay. All right, then in that case, you can use it, Martin. Now we've defined what a rear nose is. Do we have side noses?
Yes.
We have side noses.
Mercedes has side noses, right?
Yeah, they've got two there.
Oh, yeah. I thought they were like the Poirot moustaches.
Yeah. I watched that new Poirot film, which is like enjoyable apart from the fact that Armie Hammer's in it, and he seems like a terrible person from everything I've read. Allegedly. There you go, fixed it. I enjoyed the IndyCar. It obviously finished under caution, which was like, I watched plenty of American motorsports, so I'm used to things finishing under caution, but obviously it's a bit more of a disappointment if it was a really good race and it looked like it was shaping up nicely. So
yeah, it is a shame, but also it's okay for race day.
Wait, so you're saying that the race director didn't just change all the rules and allow someone around them to win the race?
Still can't.
I'm saying that didn't happen, yeah.
We're not going near that, are we?
I'm not going anywhere near that. I still can't talk about it without getting angry. I'm literally shaking at the mere thought of it.
Oh, yeah, everyone was furious, and... Pete was on his phone having arguments with Americans about it.
I still am. If I get bored, I just poke a fight. But I do want to ask you guys what you thought about the new Australia track, though, because that was novel, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
because I'm really tedious, and also because I got a new Skybox installed the week before. I watched like 3 Australian Grand Prix in their entirety, the week running up to Melbourne. And I totally forgot that Melbourne actually is a terrible track for racing. And it's easy to forget that because it's
a great track for crashing. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And it makes
the result. It's normally the first race of a season. You're really excited to see F1 again. It's 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning and you're a bit tired and you don't care almost about the quality of racing. You're just happy to see cars. You're happy to see the cars again and you're so excited to see the shiny new cars and their new liveries, new driver combinations. And it's easy to forget that... not much happens there by way of overtaking. And it did seem a slight improvement in that regard.
But that's more the cars than the track.
I've always liked the fact that with Australia being the first race of the season, it's like an extension of like mystery performance, isn't it? Because like you get all the testing and everyone's like, you don't know, you can't read into any of this bullshit, so that crap that goes on. And everyone's like, oh, these people are going to be the best, etc. You get to Australia and then like some, you know, say McLaren's dominant and everyone's like, you still don't know what's going on because Australia's a really weird track. Yeah. It's like... I don't know how weird it still is now, because it's...
I think it's still weird. I mean, McLaren were good this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
but we've had Jeddah, which is also a weird track. And we've
the tracks have been a bit weird. Bahrain's
a bit more of a conventional circuit, though, right?
Oh, San Marino next, though. Imola.
It's not San Marino. Martin, we don't have to pretend it's San Marino anymore.
I know, it's fine. I've got Emilia Romagna.
Can we just say that Imola has the best corner names of any track in the world?
Yeah, Tozer. Oh, they're beautiful.
I could just
Tamburello.
Tamburello, yeah.
I would pay River Bene good money just to lie in bed and have River Bene just whispering in the corner names of
Is Rivazza's in Imola as well, right? Rivazza's a great name.
Rivazza, yeah. Tamburello.
Tosa.
Love it.
Tosser, yeah.
Variante Alta is the high chicane as well.
Oh, isn't there Variante Bassa? Am I making things up now?
Yeah, it might be.
What's the last two corners called? Because they've got a corner.
Aqua Minerale. How could Aquamirare?
I said
well?
Aquamirare. Yeah, because,
sorry, I wasn't listening.
But then it does it randomly just have the Villeneuve chicane in there too. Just
yeah, and then there's the Piratella as well.
Oh yeah. Beautiful.
What are the last two corners? Because they're one and two, a bit like Lesmo, right?
Yeah, it's your Rabazza 1 and 2.
Rabazza, that's it. Yeah, cool. Wow, yeah, I love it. Imola's good. Track. I watched an Imola race already this weekend, which was the Blancpain. Not the Blancpain. It's not called Blancpain anymore.
GT
World Challenge. Yeah. It was a decent race. Like, Imola's a great circuit, so cars look great around there. The biggest moment of action was there was a single Bentley in there, and I admire anyone who is still running a Bentley now that Bentley have given up on GT racing entirely. There's a sole Bentley in the field, and it basically piled into the back of someone under a safety car and exploded.
Yeah, I saw that. It made a brilliant. Big old mess as well.
It's such a mess.
There was a lot of Bentley all over the road.
Yeah, and I'm feeling like Bentley parts will be in like shorter supply than they were when Bentley were actually GT racing. So
didn't McLaren try to shed a door as well?
I may have missed that.
There's quite a funny clip because it's like, because they have like the gullwing type doors, don't they? The hinge from the front, but they go up, don't they?
Dihedral, yeah, or whatever they call them, maybe.
But basically, the front of the door opened like a suicide door, and it was still latched at the back, so wow. It was like catching a lot of air.
How did
and the
that?
Commentator was like, "Oh well, yeah, he'll obviously know to slow down because that's going to be a big like air break basically, and it could fly off." And I know it's a light piece, but it's still going to cause a lot of damage if that flies off somewhere. But no, the guy's absolutely going full chat.
With his has the commentator met a racing driver before?
Yeah, he's clearly thinking, maybe I'm not going to get the meatball flag if my door's leaving the car altogether. But it's like, I don't know if that's how it works. I think you're going to come in because you're missing a car number, mirror, whatever other things are crucial to the car that you're going to miss with the door. But it was quite funny. But I was kind of hoping that one of the cars passing him was going to tag it and knock it off, but... It did. I mean, I'm quite impressed by just how the latch held on. It looks ridiculous.
That is, reassuring in a way, I suppose.
At the F1, go ahead, Martin.
No, I was going to say, we also had the debut of Rossi, obviously, Imola as well.
Yes.
I've only seen the highlights. I didn't watch the entire three race. And I know he had the pit stop.
Yeah, he did have an issue at the pits. His pace wasn't amazing initially. Like, when he first came out, he was sort of getting lapped and stuff. But once he found, like, a faster car to latch onto, like, he's kind of picking it up. He made a mistake out on track as well, in addition to the pit thing. But it's going to take him a while to get used to it, you know? Like, and, you know, he's predominantly a motorcycle rider, but I think he'll be good in GTs.
Because there was that, was it 2000? Because he nearly made the jump to F1, didn't he, in the mid-noughties? Mm. And he did that run, that famous run at Fiorano, where he wasn't that far off Schumacher's times, apparently. Is it safe to assume that this is a... basically a practice year so he can jump into the Ferrari hypercar or LMDH.
I mean, that would be incredible. That would be brilliant.
I presume that's what it's all gearing up towards. He's going to have a seat at Ferrari at Le Mans.
But in the meantime, I'm just going to enjoy him in R8 in GTWC. It's like a
oh yeah,
100%.
It's a good team. He's got a good team around him as well, isn't he?
Is he classified as a pro driver?
I don't think so. I think he's a silver. Yeah.
But so he's not classified as an AM.
No. I'd have to look it up.
But, it's a bit harsh, isn't it? If he's basically pedals bikes around.
Yeah, but there's different like levels of pro driver as well. But
I'm sure they would have had to mess up the formula to try to get him
in
there.
Yeah, because he just doesn't have the results.
But I would say about going back to Imola. Yeah. Given the fact that the F1 cars are built on budgets this year that are tighter control than they've ever been, and they're probably all kind of like. Very heavily kind of like and hastily modified from like the original spec. Do we think there's going to be at several points in the weekend someone clatters the chicane at the top of the hill and just all the parts of the car are going to fly off like a clown car?
Because obviously these cars can't touch the curbs really, can they? How can you take that chicane without just like launching it across the curbs? It's gonna just
going quite slow through there, right? So it's not gonna be a big problem. Mm. But they're so stiffly sprung because of like the ground effect stuff that it's gonna be. They're not gonna be fun cars to watch around like Monaco. So like, any slow corner like that chicane there, it's with big aggressive curbs is It's just going to basically like rattle the driver's.
How many attempts
do
they have to sort of a hairpin? They're going to have to like reverse and do like a three, like a 4-point turnaround there, won't they?
Like the Melco at Macau.
it's a sprint race, isn't it?
Yeah,
they seem bigger than last year too. Don't you think? Like, they just seem like really bloated.
They don't actually. I've got a, like I think they look sexy when they're still in motion, and I've yet to see one. Obviously, I've yet to see the trackside, and I won't get a chance to till Silverstone later this year. Yeah, they don't look good in motion. And also, the
Ferrari
porpoising
looks
doesn't...
awesome.
No,
it's a beautiful looking car.
Yeah, but even then, the porpoising, though, I think the porpoising just makes them look like idiots.
I think. Yeah, I think the problem is, like, you know, the porpoising thing, that's the regs, right? Like, that is an oversight in the regulations, as far as I'm concerned.
Because the Red Bull doesn't, like, the McLaren doesn't have that problem.
Why do you think it's an oversight, Mike?
Well, because, like, I feel like. You know, when you're building the regs, obviously you can argue that you can't ever anticipate exactly how far the teams will push it. But like, did that never come up in simulations? Did they never like go, well, actually, the only way to get a fast lap time is to have a car that's
Do you want me to roll some serious science on you guys?
Go on, please. This is what you're here for.
Yeah. Okay, so
I mean that and the knob gags. Obviously.
There's two reasons I think why, and that's not me thinking about it. I've heard people talk about this sort of stuff, and then I've made some shit up, and I'll make it sound as convincing as possible. But
when
there's two ways they're predicting the performance of the cars, right? So you got computational, and they got the wind tunnels, right? So the computational side. Anytime you're calculating the airflow on a surface and you've got that boundary layer and everything, you basically, the thinner the profile of air you're working with, the more prone to error you have to have, right? You have to basically plot as many data points as you can in that volume to then get the results you want.
Sure.
And if you've got two fixed surfaces, like the T-tray of the car and the track, and they're really close together, you just physically can't get the fidelity of data points between those two places. And the amount of data that you've got to try to track, because you've now got T-tray surface, road surface, the boundary layer associated with them, and the airflow, is the error just like exponentially increases.
Right.
It's the same thing, like, if you're going to do like computational analysis of like a beam, and you make a really thin beam, you just can't get that beam is going to flex more and it's thinner, you can't get the amount of volume and the data points in there to mitigate the error you have. So the thinner the like a letterbox opening that you have with airflow, and when you apply that to a computational scenario, then just the more error you're going to have. So they may not have thought they're going to have the problems they had. They may have put it down to error. They may have just been like, well, we need to roll the dice. We need to try to work with that whole T-tray area is very sensitive to ride height, right? You want to try and get it as close to the floor as you can. So, you know, they're probably just playing with fire. And how that error is going to propagate through their analysis is difficult to tell. Then you apply that into the wind tunnel. They're not using full-size cars, are they? They're one-third size?
Yep.
So then the air's not one-third size, right? The way it behaves is still behaving as if it's working along a full-size car. So I think it's very difficult for them to simulate very low ride height situations in the wind tunnel and on computational fluid dynamics. So, and porpoising happens when you really kind of push the car to that very, very, like, basically like running on the track sort of ride height.
The other thing I heard is, again, I'm asking because I'm a complete ignoramus to this stuff, but the cars just can't run as low as they need them to in the wind tunnel because if they would just rip up the rolling road, basically.
Yeah, exactly. There's physically limitations, so they can't actually get the car to do the things they're seeing on the track, which is...
In the last era of ground effect, I'm not old enough to have been there. I surprise you with that. But the last era of ground effect, I just remember, like, I forget which one it was, one of the Lotuses or something, that had the kind of the side pods would drop down ceramic bits, so you'd get that complete, so it closed.
Yeah, they had the skirts, so they're physically sealing the airflow, yeah.
But they're not prepared to go for skirts because it is the reason ground effect was banned was because if you lose it, like, mid-corner because of a bottoming out, then you're in real trouble if you're relying on it to get you around the corner.
Right, it's like the Villeneuve, the Gilles Villeneuve accident, isn't it?
Yep.
I think that was kind of the classic.
Yeah, I think with the when you start using like the sliding skirt stuff, you don't think you need to have, you don't need to work with as much of an aggressive like Venturi tunnel volume difference front to rear, right? So you don't have to have that. Like, I think because they're limited by the fact they can't, some airflow is going to escape out the side. They're trying to make up for that by having like a very, very low volume of air on the front end of the T-tray. So with those old school ones, they would just basically slam the sides down. They could have a really aggressive, massive diffuser on one side. The opening on the front could be quite big, really, compared to what they're doing today. But yeah, you know, I think the funny thing is that clearly the teams don't understand it. Like, yeah. Mercedes don't have a clue what's going on. And the reason really why they're so bad, and it's not like Ferrari understand it any better either. They're porpoising, but they porpoise at a high, just a high
like
enough speed, but
it's a frequency
they're not cornering
thing, basically, isn't
they porpoise,
it?
Yeah. They porpoise of a purpose, whereas the Mercedes doesn't.
But I heard it quite simply put, like, at any time where they're looking to actually enter a corner, the Ferrari isn't porpoising. But like at the end of the straight, they might. But they're getting into a braking zone and then they're turning in. The Mercedes porpoises a lot lower speed, so they might porpoise like at the speed you want to take those fast S's at Melbourne. So they'd have to then lift the car up to get rid of it, and then all the downforce just reduces by multiplying factors.
I feel like the Ferrari's like, you know, quote unquote worse in terms of porpoising, because I watched some onboards of like the helmets going, and like the Ferrari drivers, their heads were just getting absolutely like rattled about. And I'm like, is this not a safety issue? Like, you know, like they're really properly, they look like they're in a mosh pit, basically. Like, it's properly like messed
up. It's going to be funny to see. I think Ferrari are going to be quite worried about upgrades because if you're in a position where you, you know, porpoising is a fairly known quantity for you, it's happening, but it's not causing you to have like, lap time wise, how worried would you be introducing, let's say, a new floor that gives you some more downforce tweaks, and suddenly, boom, you've got porpoising happening like 30% lower speed?
Well,
like,
you can you can always roll back, I suppose, but yeah.
But that's like valuable development money that's thrown out the window, then, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's the upgrade situation is going to be fascinating this year with the budget cap. And obviously, like Ferrari said they're not going to do any Imola because of sprint race and everything, and it throws the variables in. But yeah, I'm. Because it feels like we haven't really had a development race in F1 for a while in season because of
last
couple of years.
It must be also difficult, like, to run a new floor, like, in free practice 1 and 2. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a significant... I know, like, teams rebuild cars all the time, but, like, it must be a lot easier to put a new nose on and try it out in practice than it is to...
Yeah, specify the all side noses.
whereas, like, a new floor is, like, you're basically... constructing a new car, aren't you? It's almost
I have a question about floors for Martin.
why are you asking me? What am I gonna know?
Do you know what the sexiest thing is about Formula One car floors?
They look like penises.
Okay, we'll go with that. No, you know, it's the only time when the team can put their screens up in front of their garage is when they've got the floor off the car.
Oh, no, because I didn't realise, because I thought the screen thing they banned completely because of the supposed transparency, but they can still...
For reasons I don't understand, if you got the floor off the car, you could put the screen... As if, like, you're going to see something sensitive to the car.
What happens?
Well, it's up the skirt. It's an upskirt, isn't it, basically?
Yeah. It's basically got his pants off, I think, is the problem.
But what happens, obviously, if the car has one of those amazing situations where a marshal just lifts it up on a crane and then hopefully drops it, because that's one of my favourite things in F1.
No,
I love a good overtake.
Floors on the car,
so it's
fine.
I love a car being dropped off a crane even more.
It's if you've got the floor off the car. So the moment that floor is disconnected from the car, you can pull the screen.
Because the driver's bum's showing at that point.
Yeah. And he's actually got no overalls on. He's just like...
It's just raw.
Well, they banned underwear now, so, like, it's stage one of that process.
What was the underwear thing? Because I didn't read the... I didn't read about what... I knew the jewellery thing, but then... They're not allowed to wear... They have to go commando.
I read it, and did you hear the Gasly rebuttal where he's like, the FIA can check
my
underwear
they just need to ask.
To. That was brilliant. But I don't know... There must have been... Like, I was so desperate to find out what had caused them to crack down on it. Pun. but But I don't think they ever, I don't think they were going to, but it could have been some series outside of Formula One. But I'm assuming that there was something about, like, maybe in like a practice session of some series, drivers were fined to like not wearing like their long johns or whatever. So it'd be something boring like that. Not that like somewhat, it could be that like, yeah, the really fancy like underwear pieces they're wearing right now with all the sponsors on it may not actually fully comply or something. I don't know. But
I think it's more just like everything they wear, I think they want to regulate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's like, okay, we can regulate the fireproofs, and we can regulate the actual overalls, and we can regulate the head thing and all that stuff. But if they're wearing like pants, maybe they're wearing pants made out of Semtex.
And maybe.
We can't control what their pants are made out of, and they could be highly flammable.
But that's really harsh, because of this. I don't know if he took him into F1 or not, but I remember in his Formula Vauxhall Lotus days and a little bit beyond, David Coulthard used to have a pair of lucky pants, I think dated back to his karting days.
They are definitely dangerous, I'm sure, because I'm sure he never washed
exactly,
them. Exactly,
well. Exactly. If you haven't washed them, then that's a fire hazard.
You know that by definition, when they say underwear, they do mean balaclava, the t-shirt thing, and the trousers, right?
Yeah, but that's boring. Let's just pretend they're talking about pants instead.
No, because they were saying you can't wear underwear under your. That was the thing, right? It wasn't like you can't wear underwear. It's like you've got to wear the fireproof underwear, but you can't wear anything underneath that.
No, I didn't mean it like that. I just thought they were saying like the FAA were going to crack down, making sure that everyone was wearing approved underwear.
No, they were like, you can't, because the way Albon told it, which is how I heard about it, he was like, they want to stop us from wearing underwear under our like fireproof underwear.
What? That doesn't make any sense. Those long john things are expensive. You're not going to risk getting skidders on them, are you?
And also, what if it's just Freitas and the other guy? Maybe they're just perverts.
I mean,
Freitas has a pervert's voice, definitely.
So suddenly, all the WEC drivers are like, "Finally, we're going to get some visibility to Freitas's abuse."
He's made us drive commando for years.
Do we have to clarify that these rumors are unfounded?
Yeah, they are.
This is satire, so we're protected. Yeah. I think.
We're all the biggest fans of Freitas. Yeah,
we love Freitas.
He's not had his. I don't think he's had his first F1 race yet. It's been the other guy whose name I forgot.
Is it Imola?
Yeah, I think it might. I'm not sure. I don't know if they've. Because I'm so looking forward to Freitas' first race, but it's a shame that.
But we don't hear him, do we?
I know, that's the point. I wish F1 fans could be treated to the joy that is Freitas' race direction, which is just beautiful.
Can you imagine if, like, that moment when people unfamiliar with Freitas, like, would hear
his voice? Vincent Price, end of thriller.
All of a sudden, the race turned into a Hammer horror, and it's like, oh my God, 3, 2, 1. It'd be amazing.
And like, yeah, the Horner comes up.
The midnight hour is close at hand.
And he's like, Edouard, can you just tackle that move? It didn't seem like it was quite right. And then Freitas jumps in and like he just cuts to Horner just in a heap on the pit wall. Just absolutely unconsolable. I think actually Eduardo Freitas is going to be a boss I'm going to uncover in Elden Ring at some point.
Yeah, he's got that vibe, hasn't he? Eduardo Freitas, the fell omen.
Boss music starts playing, basically, as soon as he turns up.
He's going to come on the radio and be like, tainted, our pal.
Yeah, exactly. Gasly shits himself, yeah.
With no pants to protect himself, it's all horrible. Great. Just slings out the floor.
But One thing we need to talk about, too, that I think is a good topic, is just how perfectly F1... it was racing at Jeddah when there was like firebombing happening in the background.
Yeah, and all the drivers had like a 2.5 hour meeting and then were just told that they're going to race anyway, which is like Eccleston-esque, isn't it, basically? Yeah. Bernie Eccleston would have gone in and gone, you're all racing, get your shit together and get in the car. he wouldn't have bothered with the... To be fair to Eccleston, he wouldn't have even waited for the 2.5 hour meeting. He'd have just told them like in the first 5 minutes and they'd have gone, all right.
Maybe that was what the 2.5 hour meeting was. They were just told at the beginning, you're racing. There's no point in sitting here. I'm going. And they just sat there for 2.5 hours expecting someone to come back and have a conversation with them. And that was it.
It was really grim. And the fact that it's great we have a voice, but it's like that voice doesn't seem to be heard particularly well, seeing as they have... basically said they've got no intention of not racing there, basically.
Yeah, I thought the Liberty Media stuff was going to be different, though. I thought we weren't going to be chasing, like, Middle Eastern money as much and going back to, like, historic tracks and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but I think if anything, like, it's more of a business now than it ever was, you know? Like,
yeah, on the flip side as well, not defending F1 like it needs defending, no, it's terrible. Like, the Middle East thing, obviously, it just does seem a bit imbalanced and everything. But at least there's good news that Kyle Army is apparently coming back. And
is it really? Said,
yeah, they kind of, there's a Scott Mitchell report on the race. It hasn't been confirmed yet, but it's all but a done deal, it seems. Not next year, the year after it'll be.
How close
is it
because
they think
in...
apartheid is still going on?
Yeah,
this is perfect.
We definitely need some human rights issues. You've still got that apartheid thing going on, right?
But that Lewis album. Yeah. You might want to listen this one out, lads.
But so basically, what he said as well is basically that F1 has done its Middle East expansion is now complete. It's done what it needs to do. It's finally its US expansion is complete. Miami,
so the sport washing of the Middle East is complete.
It's complete. Yeah, we've done a good job.
Yeah, totally complete. Yeah, and now it's finally time to actually.
Just because they've been in every Middle Eastern state except for like Dubai, right? Is the only one they've not. They did Qatar.
And Abu Dhabi is literally so close to Dubai.
They've done Saudi Arabia. They've done Bahrain. Like, yeah. I mean, my geography is bad, but we are running out of Middle Eastern states to visit, right?
But when are they going to realise, though, that, like, let's say take the US expansion. We've been trying to go to America for ages. We've even had seasons when we've had multiple US series races in a season.
Yeah, the East and West.
But, like, it's the same thing with football, right? The US market is so saturated with their own domestic sports.
No, that's changed so much. Like, that's complete. I don't agree with that at all anymore. It's huge. F1's absolutely. It's big.
I'm not saying it's not big, right? But the thing that makes the difference is not having races in the country. It's having drivers that people want to watch.
Well, yeah, it's back to where we started. Obviously, it's all well and good having three races in America, but without one F1 driver, without one American driver on the grids,
it is true that like Americans need someone to root for. But
yeah,
but I think if you feel like you can get the attendance right, that's the easiest way to make a quick buck. Is to have races there and know that you will basically pretty much the audience at COTA has been big. And it's going to be bigger this year, guaranteed.
And also, yeah, like you said about the American audience wants someone to root for, thanks to one of the most successful Netflix series since Netflix began. Like, they've got 20 people with well-defined characters to root for, basically.
It would blow their mind if there was an American one, though. Like, look at Hollywood movies. Like, I was at the cinema today, and there was a trailer for the Railway Children, which is like the most like British, like, you know, like genteel, like north of England, all this crap, right? And they're doing a remade film of it, but they have added an American character because they're clearly like, no American will watch this unless there is someone with an American accent in it.
Is it Scott Speed?
It's Scott Speed, yeah. Scott Speed.
No, it was Scott Speed, but he intentionally knocked someone over during filming and he's been banned. Yeah. So they had to bring in... someone else. Colin Hurtby crashed all the way.
They're really running out of Americans. But my point being, like, you know, in the same way that Hollywood is like, you got to have an American in this, even though it is set in like World War II in the north of England, probably no American went anywhere near the north of England in World War II.
But like, you know, you take Spain, right? Like, we didn't have a Spanish Grand Prix when Alonso started. No, we just
Yeah, we had
right?
Catalunya.
Yeah, Catalunya.
And then we added Valencia because Alonso was taking a lot of the attendance away from like the motorcycle crowd, right, or something like that.
Yeah, but they didn't cancel Barcelona; they just added more Spanish.
No, races. What I'm saying is that like that you know helped pull attendance away. Like, people would spend their motorsport money on something.
Yeah,
there was more chance they were going to do it. If
yeah, of course, but that was an era where like you needed to be led by the driver. So like. You wouldn't want to add a second Spanish Grand Prix unless you had a successful Spanish driver because no one would show up, right? But now with Netflix, it's like everyone's fans of these drivers because of Netflix, and that is a global platform. So yeah. Things have changed, and I feel like those races will be well attended. And the thing about Americans is they do show up for sports, and they'll travel freaking 9 hours to get to Kota or wherever.
And it's such a massive country with such an enormous population that even if you've only got like 1% of the population fans of your sport, that's more than there are in England.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
like, it does make sense. But I do think there's a bit... I'm not too sure about this Vegas thing, because you're like, well... It's going to be amazing. It's going to be fun. It's so much fun for us to watch it, because it's going to be so broken in so many ways. But like, if you're going to introduce the sport to another, to a part of the world that may not be as familiar with it, do you really want to do it with a like a hastily put together street circuit that
may or may not be the car park of Caesar's Palace? Yeah. But it's an improvement on that.
Literally anything would be better than the car park race. But if you said, I was watching... I guess there's a mod for it that the guy from WTF1 was driving.
Right.
Have you seen how long that start-finish rate is?
It's ludicrous. Yeah. It is
insane.
It's a drag race. Yeah.
It's going to be...
That's
like,
very American, isn't it? You don't do corners and roundabouts, stuff like that. It's just one big straight road. Just go flat out for...
But there's... I mean, it's going to be like Baku-esque, but more, isn't it?
They are going to have like two separate DRS zones on that straight alone. You realise that? Like... two separate detection points. I'm not even joking. It's so long that they will have a detection point on entry, a DRS zone, and then they'll have another detection point and a DRS zone because they'll want cars to be passing down that straight. I'm not even joking.
It's gonna look, you're probably right, but it is also going to look really cool. F1 cars down the strip. I've never been to Las Vegas.
You know what? I think the biggest crime with that Las Vegas thing is that they haven't added like an indoor section. Because I think if you were ever going to do an F1 race that went indoors, I think it should be like a Vegas thing where it goes through a casino.
Through the Venetian? alongside the canal?
Yeah, basically. Like, I'm amazed they haven't done it.
I'm disappointed they haven't rerouted the Mulsanne through the KFC. They should take that.
to the KFC drive-through, yeah. Kimi Kobayashi is like leaning out of a Toyota to
grab a
order
chicken
a bar. He's like a Zinger Tower burger. I don't like Vegas that much as like a place or even a concept, really. But I'm up for as many American races as they'll have. You know, if it sustains the sport, which, you know, fandom in America like will sustain the sport. My only hope is that it doesn't damage stuff like IndyCar, because as we were saying, like, I think if you compare F1 to IndyCar, you know, it becomes clear if you watch a few F1 races that these are like incredible drivers. I just hope it doesn't make IndyCar and like to a lesser degree IMSA and to an even lesser degree NASCAR into this sort of second tier of motorsport, because they do enjoy great sport in the US and they have like strong fandoms, and I do want those series to survive, basically.
I don't think it's going to threaten them too much. I think it's just a little bit strange when, like, I mean, I'm obviously more of a Formula One fanboy than the other series that you mentioned, but I do find it a little bit strange when you watch like the IndyCar coverage and the claims are these are like basically the highest technology cars with the best drivers in the world, and it's like, I don't think you need to. As soon as you start claiming those things, people will start measuring you against things like Formula One. I don't think any car needs to do that. They genuinely bring probably the highest competition in motorsport in single seaters. I think.
Yeah.
And that's all they need to do. Like, to me, if I can have it my way, and I think I should. So if someone was listening to this, feel free to change things and for my benefit. But like, F1 shouldn't have a cost cap. I don't care about racing in F1. I want to see like totally wacky cars. Like, I want to see innovation. I want to see crazy shit. I want to see engines that are all different in every car. I want to see, you know, batteries in some, hybrids in others. I want to see diesel stuff, whatever, hydrogen fuel cells, whatever works.
We
like,
had
roll
that
out.
Beat, but it was in sports car racing, and it was between the years of 2012 and 2020.
I think that's
the ideal motorsport is that we always just describe WEC from my camera.
Yeah. But that's what I feel like F1 should be. Like, it shouldn't be cost-capped. It should be a space race. And if you've got if you got on a really tight budget, but you innovate and you create something that gives you an edge that way, then all credit to you. If you want to spend hundreds of millions of pounds and you create something that's exceptional as a result, then fair play to you. And if you want to stick an OEM badge on it as a result of it, whatever. But like IndyCar, though, that's pure racing. That's basically like if you want to go from karting and draw a line all the way up to like the pinnacle of that sort of racing, that's IndyCar.
Yeah,
yeah, like, that's what I think. That's what I love. I think I've always felt that. I think you've got me into American motorsports, Mike. I wasn't really into it beforehand.
Sorry.
No, it's good. It's beautiful because it reminds me of my karting days. It reminds me of the kind of the romantic ideal of motorsport, of everyone being chums together in the paddock and hanging out.
And I think the tracks in America are absolutely phenomenal. Like, they don't get enough credit for how good the tracks actually are. And again, there's a disservice there because sometimes they'll claim their European style and it's like, stop referring to them like that. They're so good on their own.
When most European circuits now are like tilkadromes, basically.
Road Atlanta is probably one of my favourite tracks in the world. It's like a mini Nürburgring.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But it always looks... that's why it's so weird when WEC goes to COTA and everything. It feels wrong. It's not because it's like... And I know COTA's a great track and everything, but it's not... You need that kind of slightly shabby...
I'd rather WEC
went
to the Roval.
American...
I want WEC to go to the Charlotte Roval. I think that would be hilarious.
But think about it. The funny thing is, like, list like the most the endurance races, like the longer than 2 hour races that come to mind, and think about how many of them are in America. Like, because you've obviously got the Nürburgring 24, you've got
Daytona,
Le Mans,
Sebring, the
Petit Le Mans. Watkins have a 6 hour.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like these are really weird. These are phenomenal tracks, and they're old tracks, and they have a lot of character. And like we have a couple of endurance races you'd want to go to. Do you really want to go watch a really long endurance race at Silverstone, the new Silverstone?
Absolutely,
probably be
no
right.
Way.
But,
I mean, I have done. I have paid and done that. But yeah, but I know what you mean. I think also going back to what you were saying about Formula One, I think this is the unspoken thing, which is like the dark side of cars that can follow a bit better and stuff like that, is that as you're saying, like Formula One's closer to a spec formula than it's ever been, and it always feels a bit like that when the regs change, because the cars tend to come back to looking sort of quite similar.
Well, it was a pleasant surprise, wasn't it?
There was more variety than I thought.
I think we were all worried they'd look the same.
But they're going to fix the Merc and it'll start to look more like the other cars. But
they'll roll out of silver Williams. Brilliant, this will work just fine.
But all the rear wings look basically similar, all the front wings look basically similar. Like there's it kind of feels like the more they kind of fix the regs to improve the racing, the more it becomes like a spec formula, and then you're like, well, you know, might as well watch IndyCar where the cars are heavier and look more challenging to drive and all this stuff. So
I think it was right when they were coming out with like what the new regs were going to be, and I think it was on Radio Le Mans. Nick Damon. Yeah, he was talking about like he had a really good idea, and it was like, if you really want to solve the overtaking problem, make the fast car start at the back. And I know this sounds really obvious, but if you're asking the best teams to design a car that can follow and overtake, then make them have to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, even the most shed-like cars on the grid will still believe the best chance they have of doing well is just to qualify best.
Yeah.
So make the car perform in clean air, start in the middle of the pack, and that's probably where you're going to end up.
Well, it was what they always said about the Mercedes, right? It's that it was built to lead. And like in the previous seasons, they were like hedging all their bets on banging an amazing qualifying lap and then not having to worry about dirty air whatsoever. And at the point when it had to follow, it was in real trouble because it couldn't handle it. So, yeah, it makes some sense, but it feels like we're prepared to swallow, you know, a more restrictive formula because we don't want to mess with the fundamentals.
Well, and also because
we want to
couple it to a limited budget, right? We don't want to have to. And the thing is, like, I hate that. Like, I would love it if it went back to just spend as much as you possibly can. It's it's stupid. That's why it goes to places where they're firebombing oil refineries.
Because the money's there.
It's the dumbest sport on the planet, and that's why I love it. Like, don't make it more sensible.
But the problem is you would only have three teams.
You though? Because if you only got three teams, there's still a lot of money to be spread out across teams. So you just have worse teams.
Like, Haas would be like, I'm out. Like, Gene Haas has already lost all his, like, Russian funding to buy
Did you see the article? I think I sent the link to it.
I spent four and a half hours in the car. I've not read it.
Okay, all right. This is good. This is a good one. So... Mazepin's dad is like asking for his money back.
Because he built a great car.
Yeah.
He's built a really good car.
And I guess I don't understand all the words in the article because I'm a very simple person. But
some of them Russian, is that the problem?
But I guess Haas are like, no, and also you owe us $8 million or something.
I think it's good. I think they paid a lot of their 2022 sponsorship money up front, and they're asking for that back.
Well, the thing is, it's funny because there's a few different layers of this complaint, because like that's exactly what Mazepin's dad's saying, is that, I guess Mazepin senior is saying, is that like, yeah, we're not, yeah, you're not delivering us what you promised because we're not on the car, so we need our money back. And Haas are like, well, we have a clause in the contract. If you bring the team into disrepute through a number of different things, we can terminate the contract and not have to settle what's happened up to that point, so not have to exchange money, etc., etc. And they're saying that being an oligarch linked to Putin is the equivalent of triggering the clause in that contract. And they're saying that because of the fact that sanctions were put against certain parts of like the Russian businesses, and Uralkali was one of them or something like that. But they made the decision to take Uralkali off the car before any sanctions have been put in place.
Whoops.
So, oh dear.
Like, oh, it's such a harsh thing. But like, I love the fact that Haas are like, no, we're not paying the money back, but actually we're going to counter sue you for profits lost. I don't understand what that means. Like, are they just putting a car out?
Maybe they've got a load of hats that they can't sell that have Uralkali.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they pay for the merch.
It was one of the, like, not that anything nice has come out of a terrible situation in Ukraine, obviously, but it was nice to actually, it's nice for Mazepan to go, and it's nice to be able to like Haas again, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And I really
like Magnussen's such a boy.
Mag to come back. Yeah. But also, someone's... made me think as well, like, we're saying about, like, there's so much money swirling around in F1 and everything. Do we need pay drivers? I know they're part of the sport's history, but like, it still feels ridiculous to me that you have pay drivers and you have people like Mazepan on the grid, and obviously Latifi and Stroll.
But Martin, if someone's going to wake you up from your mid Formula One race snooze, what better than
a big Lance Stroll
rich Canadian
strolling apart?
It doesn't bother me at all, because it keeps more teams on the grid, right? Like, you know, like Williams would not be there but for Latifi's money. Right, it's just it wouldn't exist, right?
But surely that like, that money is just surely now gone, because doesn't he write off like two cars a session, basically?
Yeah, but so, I'm sure they bill him, basically. I'm sure their contract includes, like, if you fuck the car up, you've got to pay
as you
more
will, repeatedly.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Like, I think why wouldn't you have that clause in there? And why wouldn't Latifi go, yeah, all right, you know, I'm loaded.
I don't think any of us really understand the definition, or anyone knows what the definition of a pay driver truly is at this point, do we?
Well, it's because it's different, you know, they're all different, separate contracts, right? Like, you know, Lance Stroll's definition of a pay driver is, my dad literally owns the team.
Yeah, he's definitely
there's
a pay
no
driver.
Way I can be fired. Latifi's will be a totally different contract with a private organisation that requires his financial input to exist. You know,
yeah, with Latifi, you can't understand, but like with a Stroll situation, it's like you cannot take their ambitions to be a world champion seriously. When they've got something called Mike Crack running them.
yeah, which I don't think there's been enough jokes about that, to be honest. That is too. It's too good.
That is a Simpsons phoning Mo Tavern joke.
But also
in reality.
When the boss just insists his son drives the car and repeatedly just fucking just totals it, and it's just
but that's the only reason they exist is that Lawrence Stroll is paying for it, like, and if the cost of that team being on the grid, which, let's be honest, like when they were Force India or, you know, Racing Point or whatever, like, they were always like teetering on the brink of disappearing, like all these teams. If the cost is having Lance Stroll in there crashing every so often, I'm prepared to have it. Because
who's the best pay driver that we've ever had in Formula One?
Pastor Maldonado won a race.
Because I mean, they all bring money, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sponsor. You know, some of them are like, you know. heavily.
I guess
sponsored
once you become part, are we saying once you become part of like a junior program, are you basically on a on the Mario Kart Rainbow Road to Formula One at that point?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. I mean, well, so like, I mean, if unless you're in Red Bull, where if you piss off Helmut Marko, you're out on your ass.
So like the other drivers that are outside of that, I mean, if you just generate sponsorship by being like legit really good, then obviously you're not a pay driver. But most of the guys that have got into Formula One have rich families anyway. Then what's the point in going out looking for sponsorship if you're...
Yeah, Lando Norris's dad is one of the richest men in the UK. So like, you know, he's technically, I suppose he brought like some sponsorship and stuff. But now I think beyond a certain point, if you've demonstrated your talent, they're prepared to pay you a salary, you know, to be...
What does Lando Norris's dad... What?
I always like to think he's the guy behind Norris Skips that I see everywhere, but I don't think that's the case. I think he's in property.
Martin, you're the only person listening or participating in this podcast who knows what Norris Skips are.
Norris Skips are everywhere. Don't you see Norris Skips everywhere around the place?
I've never seen a Norris Skip.
I think his dad does something really boring that it involves being really rich. I don't know. That's all I know. Sorry, that's not
the thing about being really rich is like you don't have to be that high profile to have become really rich. You can just be like a random business person who's like made a fuckload of money, you know. And he appears to be that, like.
But I mean, I don't know. The pay driver thing to me is it's part of motorsport, isn't it?
Well, no, it's been part of F1. It's been part of motorsport since from the very start, and it's also part of its appeal that I actually quite like. Obviously, I like the idea of amateurs going up against professionals.
And we always we love a good dentist throwing.
Oh, in LMP3, yes, please.
But no, I'm just thinking in F1, it sometimes can be a bit strange when it's supposed to be the pinnacle of the sport, the best drivers, the best teams and everything, and then you get people who...
But I love it. I find it relatable. I find it relatable. I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
I would have crashed when Latifi
crashed. Having my dad buying an F1 car, F1 team for me, relatable at all.
No, like, but that bit's not relatable, obviously, but the lack of talent is relatable.
But I do think there's... It is what I think makes Drive to Survive a little bit of a surprise in terms of how popular it is, because I think there are, like, once you pull back the curtain on Formula One, you realise that it's just complete chaos. And, like, there's a lot going on that, like, it looks so glossy. And, I mean, it's the same with, like, I guess if you watch, like, the Sunderland Till I Die stuff, right? Like,
which I haven't watched, but apparently it's brilliant.
Anytime you see sport on television, automatically it looks so glamorous and well put together. And as soon as you see behind the scenes, you're like, this is basically held together with duct tape and string. But
I feel like that about everything. Like, everyone in life appears to be basically blagging it. Like, no one knows what they're doing. Everyone's, like, just muddling through. Well,
which is why it's so brilliant. These things are so good to watch, because you're like, actually, I'm not that different to these people that look really good on TV.
The problem is also the people running the country are also muddling through and doing a terrible job of it.
But I do want to bring up, going back to the Haas thing,
yes,
I think the hidden gem of Formula One at the moment, the person that I most want to meet in the whole paddock, they probably don't even go to the paddock, they're probably not allowed to, but the hero of Formula One in the last 5 years is not Max Verstappen, it's not Lewis Hamilton, it's the person that negotiates the sponsorship contracts for the Haas Formula One team. What? They're the real hero. They're the MVP. They've gone for rich energy. Absolute amazing decision that was. And that person, I'm hoping they didn't get fired. And it was the same person that goes, guys, I've got it. Russian oligarch. Kids okay at driving. They're up for it. Let's go.
Here's the thing, though, right? Devil's advocate. Does Haas benefit more from race coverage, or does Haas benefit more from being always the most entertaining episode of Drive to Survive? Because if I'm Haas, I'm like, all right, our results are shit, but Gunther's hilarious on camera. We're always in a complete like disaster mode during our episode of Drive to Survive, and you get great coverage. Like, there was an entire bit of the Drive to Survive episode, which was them desperately trying to get 1&1 to sign, you know, like a couple of seasons, like last season of Drive to Survive. It was like, they literally took them into the sponsorship meeting. If you're 1&1, you're like, great, we've got the coverage. We've been in front of a billion Netflix viewers or whatever.
I think,
like,
what answers your question, Mike, is the fact that Gunther Steiner still has a job.
Yeah.
If Haas were really that serious about being a good Formula One team, they wouldn't be interested in having good Stallone run the team. But because they want to just be the hero to drive to survive, that guy's a fucking legend.
He's been at F1 for so long as well. I always forget. Like, you watch some random race from like 2000 when Seguin Testina and a Jaguar thing heading up.
Yeah, and he was like Ford World Rally team before that. But the point is like, if I were an F1 sponsor, I actually don't care that much about the races. What I care about is being on Drive to Survive, right? So in that case, I'm like, sponsor Haas, because you'll be everyone's favourite episode of Drive to Survive and the one that everyone talks about.
Yeah, you want to have the clips of your driver comforting a crying mechanic when he's fucked up the pit stuff you sent me the other day, Ryan. It's just like, I love Haas. I think they're amazing. They are, as I said the other day, they are basically a glorified race team. They're not really a constructor, as far as I can tell. They've stolen a bunch of Ferrari mechanics that are still Ferrari engineers that are still technically employed by Ferrari. They're just kind of loaned out to Haas, and they buy Dallara stuff and glue it all together and turn up at the race.
I think they're the race team that I think we can all identify with most from our short racing experiences, because that's like the experience I had, is just going from calamity to calamity.
I feel like
what's going on.
If there's one garage you can stand outside of as a normal person and loudly say, I think the going soft, medium, soft in this race would probably be the best. Then someone leans out going, what do you say? have you got 5 minutes? So that you know what you're talking about.
That's the great thing about Haas, and long may it continue. What I also love is that, like, Gene Haas is like this Larry David style figure who desperately wants to get out of Formula 1 and would love to sell
so much to the point where they have to Photoshop him into his team face.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow he's still here.
He hates it so much.
Yeah, I adore Haas, and it makes it, as Martin said, it makes it so much easier to like them when they're not tied to Russian state funding.
Basically. Do you think once a year, like, they'll pass a document to him and he's like, this is me rustling papers.
Yeah.
He's like looking through the numbers and goes, what's this F1 thing? And they're like, oh, that's the Formula One team, Gene. He's like, I thought I told you to sell that. I know, I still work on it. Delayed till next year now. He's like, oh, yeah, we need to sell that. And then it's like, doesn't hear about it till another year goes by. He goes back to sleep.
Meanwhile, he's like 220 million in the hole.
Doesn't care, does he? I think he just likes beating up Günther Steiner.
Yeah, he does. He likes showing up to one race a year to tell Günther Steiner that he's a clown. Oh, it's
great. He like waits till the end of the race and then calls Günther Steiner. What the fuck just happened? Oh, I love it. They're clearly the best team on the grid.
They are.
Yeah, you agreed.
And I think it's one of those things too where it's like genuinely like, especially with like, I'd like Mick Schumacher to do well. Don't get me wrong, but like.
Yeah.
I also really like Magnussen to do well. And
I love K-Mag. He's a beautiful.
It's funny because like when I look at their positions on the ladder on the left hand side during the race, I can't decide if Mick Schumacher's ahead of Magnussen. I'm like, oh, good for him. And if Magnussen's ahead of Schumacher, I'm like, yeah. It's like I can't really decide which way I want that to go. But yeah, I hope they. I hope they have a good season. I hope their car isn't.
It's too difficult. Mix written off a few too many cars already. So
yeah,
it's going to
affect their development.
They've compromised their budget. Yeah,
but
and we know Magnussen's going to be in a couple, isn't he? Loves
yeah,
that.
He's got to. Yeah,
but it's fundamentally a good car. And then Grosjean's going to win the IndyCar Championship, and they'll be like, "Why don't we get Grosjean back as well?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Grosjean back to the dream team and get Rich Energy back. Rich Energy's long heralded return to F1.
Yeah, Rich
can
Energy
we crowdfund
they'll be coming back.
Can we crowdfund a half sponsor that's like suck my balls?
I would love to. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I would 100% just sponsor Haas and have my face on the side pod, like looking terrified.
No, but then you'd need to you need to get involved in some sort of scandal, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I would.
That's what the other half of the winnings is going on, basically.
Yeah. Fabricating a scandal.
So what else was going on? When's Imola? Is it 2 weeks weekend after next?
No, not this weekend.
Weekend is British GT. And is it touring cars as well? Or I made that up.
They had their launch last weekend. So normally they do that the week before, right?
Because it's
the Plato hasn't yet retired. He's retiring.
Yeah, he's unretired. Yeah. And he's sponsored by
Ural Cali.
No.
Oh.
Come on. Who is the best I mean,
Rich Energy.
Yes.
Perky Jerky.
100%. 100%. Sponsored by Rich Energy. I follow William Story, the Rich Energy guy, on Twitter, but only because he followed me first. I'm not sure why. I've no idea why.
Oh,
that
means you're complicit.
Yeah, it does. It does.
You probably owe Haas some money.
Yeah, probably do. But yeah, just announced, there's a photo of William Story and Jason Plato shaking hands. Jason Plato is unretired and is sponsored by Rich Energy.
Match made in heaven. Actually, I feel bad because Plato does seem quite nice and the Marshals like him.
He's not nice. He's a...
No, he's a pillar.
Wait, so who's less not nice? Matt Neal or Jason Plato?
I think I hate them both. I love it when they argue.
You're allowed to hate them both at the same time.
That's a fight that you want both of them to lose, don't you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. if there's some way it could be engineered that both of them would lose that fight.
The simultaneous knockout punch.
Whoever loses, we all win. The play
the double KO.
Fight.
I'm not sure if it's British Touring Cars this weekend.
Do you remember back in the day, it would be like, if those two would have knocked each other out of the race, then the cutie that is James Thompson would come through and win.
Oh, yeah, with his fabulous haircut and his beanie.
Yeah, oh, it's so nice.
Or Ivan Muller, the insouciant Frenchman.
Muller. Very saucy.
Yeah.
Did Loeb race in WTCC? Never, am I forgetting?
He did WTCC. He was in the Citroën, and they absolutely destroyed everyone.
That was when, do you remember that there was a rumour that they'd spent like test sessions pre-season driving their cars into each other to make sure they were durable enough to withstand racing?
Really?
That's incredible.
Apparently. My favourite. This is unverifiable. This is just, I could just be making
that's my
it up
perfect. That's my first, my favourite kind of rumour. My
caveat, I might have just made it up on the spot. Yeah. But
why not? It's a good story. My favourite Citroën WTCC thing was when Loeb was driving for them and was taking the Melco hairpin at Macau with a handbrake turn. Nice. Because, you know, he's a rally driver, and he was like, well, this is an extremely tight corner. Maybe I'll get around it faster if I do a handbrake turn. There's amazing clips of him doing that in a touring car.
That's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Incredible. That's almost up there with Ayrton Senna test driving the NSX in some
and
Italian driving.
Oh, yeah, he's stressed.
He's fully heel toe. Yeah.
In the most ridiculous pair of soft leather brogues you've ever seen. It's incredible.
Gentlemen, that's almost certainly enough podcast for an evening, surely. I'm not sure how long we've been recording for. Wow, an hour and 17 minutes, which is pretty good. Really.
I didn't piss once. Well, I did. I pissed in my pants twice.
You didn't pee in the toilet once.
Can we talk about... having said that that's enough podcast, I did enjoy when we did the iRacing Daytona 24 and Martin went out for his Wii.
Oh, God.
And his VR crashed his computer.
Yeah, it crashed the entire thing. I basically, a piss stop basically ruined the entire 24 for everyone. Oh, God.
Didn't ruin it. We had an amazing time. We had some great stints.
We got a podium.
We got a podium.
Yeah.
But it was really funny because I was on voice chat at the time because I was ready to take over as it happened. But all I heard was Martin like stamping around his shed going, fuck! Fuck!
It was absolute nightmare. It's one of the worst things that can happen because it's horrible you let the team down in a team event like that.
The team's called Scuderia Chicken House. It doesn't actually matter.
If iRacing knew what they were doing, they're not top 10 stuff each month. We just follow things that we've got up to on iRacing.
It's true. It's true.
Like your one and only win, Mike, in the rally cross by getting three penalties during a race.
It was Stadium Super Trucks, but yeah, my only victory on my racing was that. Anyway, I'm contractually probably not allowed to talk about video games. So let's wrap this up.
That's the scandal you were looking for the Haas sponsorship.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, thank you so much for listening, because if you are listening, it's probably because you subscribed to us 2 years ago and have failed to unsubscribe.
For that, we applaud your commitment to loving us that much.
But yeah, thank you very much for listening. Oh, we might do this again because...
I think we should do.
At the very least, it's an excuse for us to all drink and talk nonsense every so often. So thank you for enabling that, and we will see you next time. Bye!
Bye! Bye-bye.